The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greeting friends around the world, this is Garner Ted Armstrong with the good news of the world tomorrow. Plans move along now toward the launching of Gemini 9, and even though Gemini 8 had to abort after some anxious moments during which the space capsule tumbled wildly, the Gemini 8 mission was a significant step in the space program. I was at the Cape for the twin launchings of the Atlas Agena unmanned space satellite and the blast-off of the Titan carrying astronauts Armstrong and Scott aloft, and it was an awesome sight. It was certainly totally unlike anything I'd ever seen on television before, and like a lot of you, I'd watched many such launchings on TV, but I'm afraid the calm, steady, practiced voice of a TV announcer or the controllers at the Houston Space Center don't quite convey the stark reality and the almost frightening aspect of such twin launchings. And of course, this was impressive because it was the very first time that two simultaneous countdowns had proceeded along at the same time and the two launchings took place so close together. And the stark reality of that was far more impressive than anything I'd ever seen before of any like, and in spite of the fantastic coverage that U.S. news media give the public, this was the first time for me, and I noticed that even veteran newsmen, people from CBS, NBC, ABC, Time, Life, Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report, Paris Match, London Daily News, publications all over the world from Japan, Spain, Germany, everywhere, and yet not a one of these veteran newsmen or photographers were entirely blasé about the launching of Gemini 8. There was a dead calm and a hush that fell over the whole gallery there, a couple of thousand yards from the launching site as these huge missiles clattered and popped and stuttered their way out into orbit. Now, one major achievement was the launching itself, the twin countdowns, and the other, of course, was the docking of the vehicle, even though it didn't last very long and though the mission had to abort a little bit later. But it has been hailed as a major step forward, nevertheless, in spite of the difficulties. But the question is, just where is this leading us? 10 years ago, there wasn't one single orbital satellite above this Earth. Today, there are many hundreds, and the plans for the future seem both energetic and fantastic, both thoroughly planned and a little vague. And remember, it was in 1965 that man first walked in space and remained aloft for 2 weeks, a lot longer than ever before. And even though substantial loss of blood mass resulted, it was still hailed as another breakthrough and a major achievement in the steps toward the moon. But what will the next 10 years bring? Well, spacemen have some very awesome predictions indeed. By the year 2000, they say, we might well have launched one or more probes to every one of the planets in our solar system. But could we explore beyond the solar system, they begin to wonder. Well, they say if we propel a rocket the speed of more than 26 miles a second, which is escape velocity from the sun at our distance from it, we could then get that rocket to leave our solar system forever. Forever. That's quite a word, isn't it? And if we aim it correctly, they say, it will eventually approach Proxima Centauri, which is the nearest star next to the sun, or any other object toward which we might send it. Unfortunately, even the nearest star, they say, is 7,000 times as far away as Pluto. Now, there are major stages of space travel that scientists are now envisioning. And when I say they're a little vague, you'll have to listen to just a part of it to realize just how vague they really are. The flight of an unmanned probe to this Proxima Centauri would by itself take many centuries of time. Now, in an article appearing in a Texas newspaper not long ago from Isaac Asimov, who is an editor, a widely read scientist and writer, and he was looking at the adventures far ahead in the far reaches of the space programs of many nations and trying to say where man is headed in the next centuries, not just one or two decades, but centuries ahead. And he said that we must conclude that although we will soon have the ability to explore the entire solar system by instrumented satellites, we will, by the year 2000, already have gone about as far as we can in that direction. Well, then, could we expect humans to land on Jupiter or Mars in the next few years? Where would man be likely to go in the next century and one half? Now, as it is today, as you might have heard President Johnson said in watching the twin launchings recently of Gemini 8 and the Atlas Agena unmanned space vehicle, he predicted then we will be on the moon before 1970, and this is 1966. Now, they're saying once we reach the moon, just about nothing can stop us.
because then we can begin ferrying machines and supplies back and forth. Of course, the step to the moon would be space platforms. This docking maneuver was one step in that direction. Or we could establish shuttle service back and forth to a space platform, taking machines, equipment, new supplies, performing various work upon it with specially designed space tools, a replica of which I saw at the Cape just the other day, and some of the news releases on it talking about specially designed power tools for use out in space during the proposed space walk of astronaut Scott, which of course did not occur, but which they hope will occur during the orbit of Gemini 9 when this does come off, if it does successfully. So an underground cavern, they hope, will be gouged out and then sealed over and made quite comfy on the surface of the moon. And by 1980 or 1985, such a base may exist. Now, this man continued that the second stage of space exploration, a trip of many months, would place the inner solar system within our grasp. And maybe we should say within our clutches, because it makes you wonder who's going to get there first and then what purposes would they put it to. Now, this would include the planets of Mars, Venus, and Mercury. And, of course, Mars is supposedly the least forbidding of all of them, despite its extremely thin and arid atmosphere. And it just possibly, they say, still in spite of the pictures we received back at JPL in Pasadena, it might just possibly have some simple life forms on its surface. That's what they say. Now, whether that is true is another question entirely. But before men can reach Mars, they must spend 6 months or more in space. Now, I don't know whether they'll have any red blood cells left at all at that time, but this is a problem they're working on. Then, if they make Mars by 1985, there could, let's say, be a permanent station established there by 1995. And then, from those stations, they could go on to the two tiny Martian moons, Deimos and Phobos. Then trips to Mercury, Venus, and others would come. Now, the third stage of space exploration, which would involve voyages lasting many years, would be done in graduated steps between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. Remember, there are thousands of asteroids circling around, some of them 100 miles and more, one of them 480 miles in diameter. And once they get to Mars, they might take trips to those asteroids. And that wouldn't be too troublesome, they say, to reach those. As early as maybe 2000, men could have landed on Cetes, one of the asteroids circling around Mars. Then by 2025, they may well have landed on one or another of Jupiter's satellites. And a century from then, a landing could have been made within Saturn's satellite system. Now remember that Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus are planets, they say, are whipped by winds so awesome, so as to be completely unmeasurable by any devices known to man today. Constant hurricanes of such force so as to be measured, if we had any method of measuring them, at maybe hundreds upon hundreds, maybe thousands of miles velocity of fierce winds and maybe horrible gases and deep poisonous atmospheres with incredible frigid blizzards and storms whipping their surfaces. So obviously nobody wants to go there. But they want to get as close as they can, for some reason. Now, the fourth stage of space exploration, voyages lasting many centuries, said Isaac Asimov, would take us, not you and me, I should clarify, because we won't be around by then, and maybe none of us will be if something goes awry with all of this fantastic plan, but nevertheless, will take us, he said, to the planets of the nearest stars. And even the most advanced rockets you could imagine cannot go faster than the speed of light. And at the speed of light, a round trip to the nearest star would take exactly 9 years. That would be quite a voyage, wouldn't it? 9 years sitting in one spot. Well, this is what they're talking about. Now, there's a third way out. They say that once our solar system is colonized, there will be men and women who may never have seen the Earth, who may have been born on Mars. And their underground home on Mars would not be too different from that on a spaceship, and the change from one to the other would be quite possible. They say these may be scrawny, skinny, undernourished little people with large heads, giant brain power, great emotional and mental stability, so they say, and with small, stringy muscles. Well, that might be desirable for some people, but not me. Now, they said that when expeditions are finally sent to the stars, we need not expect to see them come back. Because, you see, a successful expedition to any but the very nearest stars could not possibly return to Earth in the same century as we count time, nor would it be possible to communicate with any human colonies because it would take dozens of years, even centuries, for radio signals, if they could be boosted and become powerful enough to travel in such a fashion, for radio signals or beams of communication to reach the colonies, and it would take an equal amount of time for the colony to answer. Now, isn't that amazing? Isn't that fantastic? And yet, what I witnessed recently at Cape Kennedy is just one more step in exactly that direction. But the question is, why? What's it all for? Why go anywhere in that kind of a circumstance? Just to say you've been there, you come back, what, 2 centuries later and say, I've been there? Well, you're not still alive. To say we can do it? Well, that's fine, but is it going to benefit you and me? In other words, you and I are alive today. Now, all of these fantastic plans about reaching stars and reaching the various planet systems of stars way out in the outer reaches of our solar system, and from there to reach other parts of the galaxy are so incredible, even a part of the Milky Way, you know, as we call it, that you can just forget about that, because even all the fantastic things I've just been saying to you don't envision going to the other side of the Milky Way, and that's only one galaxy out of maybe thousands, and who knows, maybe millions. And those little pinpricks of light you see winking up there, most of them, of course, are huge stars, and our sun is just an orange dwarf, and it, of course, is so much bigger than the Earth that it's incredible. And most of those stars have their own planetary systems and may have many, many moons around each planet. And this is so incredible that it's hard to imagine. But the question is why? Just to say we can do it? Now, you need not delude yourself that it's just a scientific endeavor on the part of man to discover more about his environment or to discover more about the origin of the universe. Don't kid yourself that the military implications of this fantastic race to conquer space and get a base on the moon and orbital satellites and platforms around the Earth are not far more important than the purely scientific knowledge that man is obtaining. Anyone should know, whether you are familiar with the technical aspects of the space program or not, that world dominion is at stake, and it's not going to wait to be decided by 2025 or even 1982. We are right now at the very moment in world history where we're claiming we will have men walking around on the surface of this moon up above in less than another 5 years. Can your mind imagine that? This is 1966, and President Johnson says before 1970. Military bases on the moon? Do you think the first nation to get on the moon, if we in the United States are first, would not immediately begin to take advantage of the fantastic geopolitical and military aspects and exploitation that such a base would bring? Do you think for one moment that any nation that had many, many space platforms orbiting around this Earth with manned capsules, possibly H-bombs inside of them, reached by ferries, shuttle service back and forth, changing, altering, servicing, resupplying such bases, and a base on the moon, do you think for one moment almost immediate military advantage would not be taken? That exploitation of such a position would not be taken immediately by any great power that should reach the moon first? Why, that makes all the rest of this vague sort of a study about space exploration under the guise and the cloak of science sound like just so much of one big pipe dream, one hazy, empty-headed guess that is never going to come to pass, because the big question is whether or not there will be a man, woman, or child left alive on this Earth in the next 10 years. Now, overall, when you look at it, here we are in this incredible mid-60s, this space age in which we live, with the largest single United States industry devoted and committed completely and entirely to space. The newest industry, $9.2 billion payroll per year. About $1 billion I saw go up in smoke the other day. About $1 billion worth of explosions. And that is a lot of money. Now, it's the biggest industry on Earth today. And these aren't men playing with toys. There is a sort of a spirit that grips you as you're over in that area. There's a dizzying sort of a bug-eyed fascination these men have with getting to the moon. And these are dedicated, fast-thinking, trained, educated, intelligent, purposeful men. These are men with a goal. These are hard-driving, energetic men that know exactly where they're going. And yet, you hear them make vague references to the universe, the origin of it, about the next step in space. And all of it is supposed to be cloaked under the guise of science. But let's come back down to Earth just for a moment and realize that we could find a great deal more about the origin of the universe by looking more thoroughly at the one biggest chunk of evidence we've got about us, and that's this Earth and its own environment. Because we're in our own spaceship, you know, we're taking our own journey. That's right, you're in a spaceship on a journey through space, and you're comfortable. You can move around on it. You're protected by a far more effective heat shield than astronauts Armstrong and Scott were. Always perfect attitude control, no violent tumbling or yawing here. But instead of the sun coming up and going down about every 40 to 60 minutes, it's only every 12 hours, and our air is not produced by recirculating through mechanical apparatus and adding oxygen artificially inserted, but by blades of grass. And our protection is not in a thin metal shield, but in a thick mantle of air that burns up thousands of meteorites and filters out all the deadly rays every single day, perfectly in complete and perfect control. We're taking such a trip. Where are we going? Well, it seems that we're on a certain course, that we're in a certain attitude, and we're headed in a certain direction. And our colony is living here and farming here and eating the stuff that it grows here, just as they envision colonies in giant spaceships doing in the future. But why are we taking such a trip? Just to say we've been there? To say we've lived? To say we've experienced? To say we've lived and breathed a little while? This is exactly all that they would be doing in a spaceship which took centuries to arrive at its destination. People would be born, grow up, live, and die, and as they expired and they threw out the junk to orbit endlessly in space, a burial in space, their dying breath could be, "I have been on a journey through space." What will they have done? What will they have contributed? I mean, this is fantastic. When you begin to think that people are thinking of getting so far away from the Earth that a signal could not even reach them in short of a million years and could never return back to the Earth in the living generation of maybe multiple thousands of generations of people, so far as that's concerned, then, to use a funny phrase, what earthly good is it? Why are you alive, do you know? Are you alive so you can get off the Earth and take a trip into space? Why are you in your spaceship, protected by this vast envelope of air, taking a trip on your colony through time and space? To say you've lived, to say you've been there, you've taken the trip, you've been traveling a while. You know, somehow we just know there is an inner conviction. We know there is more to it than that. We feel it, we sense it. Yet we're looking to nothingness, to vastness and emptiness for proof, instead of to the completely unalterable, tangible evidence of the billions of tons of material beneath our feet and all around us. Now, the origin of this universe is known. It's already been discovered. The exact beginning of it, how it came together, what caused it, why the Earth is just exactly in the attitude and the distance from the sun with the moon around it, why our magnetism, why the Van Allen belt, why tides and the effect of the moon upon us. All of that is already discovered. The whole thing has been cataloged. The entire story of the origin of the universe is already complete. It's revealed. And the reason and the purpose of life upon this Earth, the whole purpose in this fantastic trip through space of ours, has already been revealed in the Bible. Now, doesn't that sound almost funny? And that proves a point. It ought to prove a point to you. You know, people say that God is dead today, and if they mean the kind of God imagined by millions who is dogging the heels of Skid Row derelicts and tramps, and who is doling out soup to a lot of down-and-outers, and who is trying to get ignorant savages to sing, "Yes, Jesus loves me," then I'll agree that God is dead because he never lived. There never was such a God. And if you mean some kind of a beatnik with long brown locks and long tapering fingers and a slender aquiline nose and petulant lips and a sort of "I'm hurt because you won't believe on me" expression, that God is dead too. Dead as a doornail because he never lived. There never was such a person. There never was such a God. But if you mean the great God who created the universe, who directs this Earth on its trip through space, who is at the master control system of this great universe and who keeps the Earth going, who sustains the sun, who gives you every breath of air you breathe, and who works out his plan here below, that God is alive, always has been, and always will be. And if you mean the Jesus Christ, who was a young, dynamic man with shorter hair, who looked just like any commoner and average person of his day, who was a carpenter's son and a stonemason at that, and who came not trying to convert the world, but said, "I'm not here to convert the world. I'm not trying to save the world at all. I didn't come to bring the world peace." If you mean the one who said he didn't come to change the law, the one who said he didn't come to bring the world peace, the one who said he did not come to establish a sort of little struggling religion and hope that it survived for a few years, if you mean the God who says in the Bible, "Take your pick, call to your gods, maybe they're asleep and far off somewhere," that God is alive. If you mean the God who says, my purpose shall stand, my plan will work out, my government is going to rule this earth, that God is very much alive, and whether you like to believe it or not, it's true. And that God, while he does care whether or not you believe it, he gives you the privilege not to believe it. He gives you the privilege to scoff and to wallow around in the biggest laughter you can get out of a big joke, as you might think it is. But he's not going to obligingly step out of existence because a lot of people don't believe he is. That God can be proved. And right now, for the next few years, that God is allowing you to prove it to yourself, just like you would go check up on the physics and the chemistry and the science of the things around you, just like you might study the contraction of water or the expansion of metals. That God can be proved. If you'll write for the book that's Does God Exist and Approve of the Bible, and this is not an altar call. It's not an altar call. You can believe what you choose. You can make up your own mind. You can kid yourself. You can delude yourself. You can get a big chuckle out of it. Or you can hang up your shingle with the scientists who want to take a trip from which they admit they will never return. You can take your pick and believe what you would like. But you can also come down off the fence of doubt and indecision and wonderment and guesswork, and you can prove a few simple things to yourself. And right now, that God who does exist, who says he is the first and the last, is allowing us the time to either prove it to ourselves or not to prove it to ourselves. In a few more years, that God says he will come with a strong hand and his arm is going to rule and his work is going before him. That's what he says. And he doesn't ask people to believe it. And nobody's going to have to start a big round of applause to get him to come back down to this earth and straighten us out. Nobody's going to have to urge him to come because the countdown has already begun in heaven. There has begun already a countdown when the one who was Jesus Christ of Nazareth on this earth is going to launch himself on a trip through space, and he is going to appear in this earth's atmosphere, and he's going to shock the daylights out of millions of people. And the day in the future when a huge, rumbling, popping, fantastic series of explosions seem to tear your very being apart as the heavens roll back and a blinding light 10,000 times brighter than the sun makes you crawl on this earth and grovel in the rocks and hide your face and wonder what's happening. You won't have time then to check an encyclopedia. You won't have to worry about the cleavage properties of minerals and find out what water is and decide for yourself whether or not you're on a spaceship on a journey through space and what your life consists of. You won't have to answer simple questions of household physics and try to discover their origin. You won't have to worry about the origin of the universe, the hydrogen atom, just what a molecule is. You won't have to worry a little bit about death or life or the hereafter or heaven or hell or judgment or anything else. You and every other human being on this earth, whether he speaks Azerbaijani or Hindi, or whether he talks in some guttural, unwritten tongue of Central Congo, is going to know that there is a great ruling being that is coming back to this earth. Whether he accepts his government or not is something else again. Now, I'm not asking you to believe it. I'm just telling you the way it is. You can believe it or not. That's up to you. But for those who want to prove it to themselves and get on the right side of the fence while there's still time, well, then that's your privilege. Now, God says through Isaiah, in Isaiah the 40th chapter and verse 12, who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand and meted out heaven with a span and comprehended the dust of the earth in a measure and weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance? We can't answer the origin of life. We can't answer questions about this earth around us, and yet we're trying to go out into space and trying to take fantastic trips from which we know people may never return. But the one who says he is God says the nations are as a drop of a bucket and are counted as the small dust of the balance. Behold, he takes up the isles as a very little thing, and Lebanon isn't sufficient to burn, nor the beast thereof sufficient for a burnt offering. All nations before him are as nothing, he says, and they are counted to him less than nothing and vanity. To whom then will you liken me, says this person, claiming he is God, speaking through the pen of a prophet? Or shall I be equal, says the Holy One. And then he said in verse 26 of Isaiah, the 40th chapter, take a look at space. Look out, because you don't look up, you look out, look away. Lift up your eyes on high, and behold, who has created these things? Would you like to guess about the origin of the universe? Good. Have at it, because your guess is going to be just as beautiful and just as accurate and just as tangible a guess and just as close to the truth as the ones that are getting front page prominence in some of the biggest news magazines on earth today. Would you like to guess that it was once scattered and came together, or guess that it was once together and became scattered? Would you like to guess that it gradually came into being, or it's gradually going out of being? Take your pick. They've got everything at every end of the poll, and that's all they know to say. At one time, there might have been a huge star. Where was it? Well, hanging in space. What space? They don't know. What's a star? Well, it's solid matter, and it exploded. What is an explosion? What causes an explosion? Isn't it law, force, energy? Well, it exploded, and then all little particles became giant super suns, thousands of times bigger than ours, and we're a little tiny fragment like a little Earth orbiting around our sun in the solar system, and here we are, little kind of struggling life forms on it. And it's nice and comfortable and convenient because that way people can do away in their own conceited mind for the idea of a God and the idea of a life giver and a law giver, the idea of the one sitting at the master panel at the switch of the controls of this space capsule of ours that is on its trip endlessly through space, and the one who says you're accountable not for your trip but for how you act during it, the one who says you're accountable for the way you live, for your mind, your nature, your personality, your honesty, your integrity, your ability. The one who says you're accountable because you've got a job to do and you better find out what that job is, what your calling and your purpose is in life. But we come up with these vague guesses because we'd like to get some way to get that conscience to quit bothering us. And when we're out with somebody else's wife, or when somebody's cheating on her husband, or when we're divorcing for the fourth time, or people are contemplating a crime, or the white-collar worker has his hand up to the elbow in the boss's till, or when people want to live every kind of a rotten, insane, upside-down and backward way and then claim everybody else is doing it, why shouldn't I? Or the high school senior says, sure, I cheat, doesn't everybody? Or the 17-year-old girl says, sure, I indulge in free love, doesn't everybody? We would like that conscience to get out of our way and quit nagging at us, and so we'd like to say there is no God or God is dead. And all it takes is a woman atheist to stand up and say it and start fighting it in the courts, and millions of people docilely and humbly like a pack of blatting sheep get right behind the whole act and on the bandwagon and wave the flag and say, yay, I'm for you. The ultimate irony of all is atheism. Atheism, agnosticism, skepticism, and perhaps maybe even one step worse than that, is the idea of millions of people who claim to believe in a God, but who make that God in their own image and call him an old ancient fellow with a beard and then have him conveniently retire as a doddering old professor that is full of forgetfulness, an inane, inept, confused old man who has no power to intervene. The God that I serve, the God that I represent, the God who is the director and the sustainer of this great work that you're hearing right now, has said he's going to send Jesus Christ back to this earth, and it doesn't matter whether we believe it and applaud loud enough to get him to do it. He is going to do exactly that, and the countdown has already started. And whether you prove it or not to yourself, it's going to be proved to you, but if you want to write to these booklets, they're free, and we'll give them to you, and this is no altar call, and there's no follow-up, and there's no cost. Here is this full-color booklet, Who Will Rule Space? It's free of charge, absolutely no price. The Plain Truth magazine is full-color, free of charge, no price. Who Will Rule Space gives you the outcome in advance. If you want it, write to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. Give us a call, letters at your station. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.